thank you for taking the time to listen to this life-changing message from the Ministry of Faith Bible Chapel. We hope this message will encourage you in all parts of your life. At the end of this message, you will hear more information on how to contact our church family, as well as directions for you to visit us for any of our worship services. Until then, join us for the service in progress.
With us, and he has become a friend of ours and a real asset to getting the message out, and that is a message that we need to be ever aware that there is evil in our world, and that evil has all intentions to stop the purposes and the will of God for all of mankind. And someone might ask, well, why would you have someone come to the pulpit on a Sunday morning and share his story? He is a Holocaust survivor, and I'll introduce him in just a moment. And there's a real good answer to that. It's because we need to understand that from the very beginning, when God had a plan to rescue man, basically rescue man, because man turned his back on God, and we begin to drift far away from God, but God, not willing to give up on mankind, had a plan to come back down and reach us. But the enemy also, somewhat knowing some of this plan as it was unfolding, did everything he could to stop God's will from being performed on this planet. And I don't have to go into a whole lot of history, but I just think about the things that happened to Abraham and Isaac and to Jacob, and then as we move forward to the children of Israel, as they found themselves in bondage in Egypt, God raises up a Moses. But what happened at the very beginning of Moses' life? If God had his hand on Moses for him to be the deliverer, the enemy did everything he could to do away with Moses. And that decree went out from the Egyptian Pharaoh to kill all the children. Moses was one of those babies at that particular time. Moses' parents, being willing to put their faith in God, set him afloat on a river, and then one miracle after another. We all know the story. But if you'll just trace, that's just one of many stories how God has intervened and kept his vision alive to reach all of mankind. We come up to just this last century of ours, and that has been during the 1930s, 1940s, when there was World War II. And we had the Nazis that had come into power, and what did they try to do? They tried to eliminate the Jewish people totally. Unfortunately, 6 million of Jews perished. 1.5 million of them were children at that particular time. It was the hand of the enemy trying to, again, stop the purposes of God from being fulfilled. But it couldn't do it. As horrific as it was an event, out of that came the nation of Israel, the Jewish people returning to their land as God had promised to fulfill once again his promises to all of mankind. Listen, if you can't get your mind wrapped around that, it is an amazing thought. And it's just amazing to understand the power of our God and what he wants to fulfill. I always say this, if God is faithful to those promises to Israel, he will be faithful to you in a very personal way. You can believe him and you can trust him. Well, this morning we do have with us someone that's going to speak to us, but I want to take a moment before we do that. If you received a handout as you came in, it's very plain. It tells you about the events that are going to take place, that are taking place right now. It actually started early this week. We usually don't get the opportunity that we had this past week, but one of the displays that you will go through, exhibits, is the Holocaust room. And our youth department had put this together with the help of their parents and the leaders of the youth department. And you'll want to make your way through that. But we opened that up on Friday. And we had over 400 elementary and junior high kids go through it. 450 of them go through that. So they hurried up and they got it done and were able to do it on a school day. And so all day they were going through that. And that was a great educational experience for them. That is available today. But if you just glance at that, there are things that are going on right now simultaneously while we're in here. There are people that are meeting in seminars, and next hour you see that they're there. So it's all right here. Look at it. It will It's something you don't want to miss. So you want to take advantage of every opportunity this afternoon. And then we'll gather back here this evening at 6 o'clock. And all this is about that. And you'll see not only these children, but about 150 more of them that are part of the program. It's just a wonderful presentation. Every part of it has a message, the video, the drama, the singing, and the speakers that will be with us tonight. Our main speaker tonight is Pastor John Hagee. He will be coming in this afternoon, and he will be speaking to us tonight. We'll have a lot of Jewish and Israeli friends that will be with us, so open up your hearts and your arms and be friendly and smile and just get acquainted with a lot of people that are coming and take advantage of all the activities. Lots of food this afternoon, falafels and hot dogs for you Americans and pizza and dancing, and the young people will be dancing everything over in the West Gym. We are celebrating. We are celebrating the goodness of God, the faithfulness of God. Our speaker this morning is Irving Roth, a young man that has more energy than 5 or 10 of us in this room. He has been using these recent years of traveling from one college campus to another. He's the director of the Holocaust Resource Center at Temple Judea in New York. He works tirelessly and to convey the lessons that can be learned from his personal experience in the death camps in Poland. He actively works to ensure that such atrocities as the Holocaust never happen again. Irving also travels around the country on behalf of Christians United for Israel, which we are a big part of, speaking at local nights to honor Israel, which we'll have tonight, as well as representing Christians United for Israel on campuses, colleges, universities around the nation. He has received the Spirit of Anne Frank Award and is one of the most sought-after Holocaust educators throughout Europe, Israel, and the United States. He has a book with him, Bondi's Brother. This is available at a table right in the center of the atrium area. In fact, he will be back there afterward to sign the book. You need to get it. It fills in all the pieces about the story that you need to hear. So would you give a warm welcome now to Irving Roth as he comes and speaks to us this morning.
Thank you, Pastor, and shalom, brothers and sisters. It was a balmy evening in May of 1944 when I arrived in Auschwitz at the age of 14. The scene that greeted me were guards with submachine guns, dogs, screaming at us, yelling, "Heraus, mach schnell!" Take nothing with you. In the distance, flames coming out of chimneys. Get in line. Orderly, said the guards. Days from 3 days in a cattle car, I fall into line. On one side is my brother. On the other side, my grandfather. My grandmother next to him. My aunt and my 10-year-old cousin, all marching. Suddenly we're facing a man in uniform who simply with his riding crop, left and right, left and right. A selection. My brother and I go to the left. My grandfather, my grandmother, my aunt and my 10-year-old cousin to the right. They're marched to those buildings, the chimneys and flames. 24 hours after I arrived in Auschwitz, my grandfather was no more. My grandmother, my aunt, and my 10-year-old cousin, smoke and ashes. How is it possible that in 53 days, 437,000 human beings in Hungary are loaded into cars, arrive in Auschwitz, and 24 hours after arrival, nothing but smoke and ashes. All this was done by only 250 members of the Nazi party who came from Berlin. The rest of them were policemen in Hungary. The same policemen who lived side by side with my parents, my grandparents, for decades. How is it possible that ordinary law-abiding human beings, moral beings, participated in the murder of 6 million Jews? Unfortunately, the answer is very simple. It began with the demonization of the Jew. The Nazis accomplished this in a very simple fashion. They put it into the educational system. Children from age 3 to however long they were in school, they were taught that Jews are not human beings, they're demons. The propaganda was there for the adults. To the Christian neighbor, the Jew was no longer a person. He was evil incarnate. This was necessary, the first step. And then it followed. Isolation, persecution, concentration, and murder. I was an eyewitness to that. I lived through that. Not exactly in Germany, but in country that was once Czechoslovakia, now it's called the Slovak Republic. I was born there in 1929, went to school, played soccer, had friends, Jews and non-Jews alike. In fact, the first day of school, I spied a young lady, 6 years old like I. I walked to school with her after a while. By the end of that year, I was carrying her books. As time went on, I did homework with her. But soon came 1939. And suddenly the country that is called Czechoslovakia, this democracy based on the model that America presented to them, suddenly no longer existed. It was not called Slovakia. It took on all the characteristics of the Nazi regime of Germany. And so persecution in my small city of 7,000 people begins. How did I know? After all, in 1939, I was not quite 10 years old. I knew it because one day in the summer of 1939, I get up in the morning to meet my friends in the park, and as I get close to the park, I see a new sign. Jews and dogs are forbidden to enter. I played in that park. My Christian friends all went in. I couldn't. Other restrictions. One day my father tells me that it's winter of 1939. He tells me, you know, Irv, that jacket you've been wearing, the warm jacket that your grandfather gave you, that fur-lined jacket, you can no longer wear. We must take that jacket and take it to the police department. I say, why? It's my jacket. It's cold. Jews are not allowed to own or wear any luxuries. A fur jacket is a luxury. And time goes on. By the time 1939 comes to an end, one day my little friend who I've been walking to school with all these years, when we did homework together, tells me, my father told me not to walk with you anymore because he does not want to be known as a family that loves Jews. As the summer ends of 1940, I'm ready to go to school. After all, that's what all students do all over the world. And so I get up in the morning, I get to school, the principal is standing outside the gate. And suddenly I see that some of my Jewish friends are not going in. And as I approach the gate, he looks at me and says, Rolf, you can't go in. I say, why not? I've done nothing wrong. We don't want any Jews in our school. So I am thrown out of school, not because I've done something wrong, because of who I was. One of my favorite things to do was play soccer. If you ask me what my favorite subject, I would say lunch and soccer. The rest of them, you know, I could take or leave. So I decided in the afternoon, though I didn't go to school, let me go out into the field. Let me play with my friends. I get to the ball field, and the coach tells me, you can no longer play. We decided we don't want any Jews on our team. Now, mind you, that wasn't even the law. There was no law that says Jewish kids are not allowed to be in a sports team with non-Jews. But the idea the Jews are different, they're the evil, they're the devil, penetrated the minds of our friends. When I was thrown out of school, so was every single Jewish teacher. Jewish attorneys could no longer practice law. And slowly the economic oppression begins. And at one point we hear a rumor that Jews can no longer own businesses. My father had a lumber business. He produced railroad ties. Tens of thousands of them, ship them all over Europe. And so now we're in a position we may lose that business. So how are we going to live? And so my father conceives of an idea, calls one of his non-Jewish friends, he's known him for about 3 decades, close friend. They worked together at one time as young men, continue to be friends, and tells him, Albert, I need some help. He said, what is it, Joe? What's going on? He says, well, you know, this law is coming into being that I as a Jew can no longer own the business. So would you lend me your name? So they renamed the business. We'll sign some documents. And suddenly, the business is no longer Roth. It is now Melesnik. And therefore, it's a non-Jewish business. And no one can come and take it away from me. That's another problem, says Albert. Absolutely, why not? I have my own business. Why should this be so? And so the papers are signed, and everybody in my town, every Jew loses his business, not my father. 3 months go by. One day, Albert, his bosom pal, comes over and says, Joe, we're partners. I want half the profits. Another few months go by, and one day he shows up. The books under his arm, he says, Joe, I like the way you're running my business. I'm not going to fire you. Betrayal. And so time goes on. It's 1941. Europe is controlled by Germany. Either as allies to Germany, like Hungary and Italy, and Bulgaria and Finland, or they're occupied. And so the laws against the Jews are filling all of Europe. The Jews of Poland are already in ghettos. And so Germany decides, it's time to get rid of the Jews, physically. In June of 1941, Germany attacks Russia. More Jews, 11 million of them. And so they decide in a simple plan. We'll organize 5 battalions of older folk, because the young ones are in the army fighting the war. We'll teach them how to fire a machine gun. We'll send them out. And they're going to villages and towns and cities, eastern Poland, the western Russia. That's where you're going to begin the process. The process is going to be simple. They'll go into town, get a list of Jews, tell the young people, the young men, to come out for work. March them into the field or into the forest, dig a ditch, and then machine gun them. But the ditch is not full. And so the next morning, they announced every Jew must gather in the marketplace or town square. to be resettled. And so they marched out into the same ravine, into the same ditch, and machine gunned. Day after day, week after week, month after month. It began in the summer of 1941. It continued. 500,000 Jews were murdered in this fashion over a six-month period. By whom? By these five battalions of men. Who would be so callous? Only psychopaths would do that. Unfortunately, the men who were involved in murdering Jews, babies and old people and everything in between, were ordinary men. Doctors and lawyers, farmers and pharmacists, teachers, businessmen, the roster goes on. But the government realized very quickly that the 11 million people, it's going to take forever. By higher mathematics, if you can murder 500,000 in 6 months, it's going to take you 11 years, and there is no time for such thing. And so they organized a conference in a place called Wannsee, a town outside of Berlin. And there, the brains of Germany, the doctors, the chemists, the engineers, the scientists gather. The transportation experts, army people, to solve the problem. The final solution to the Jewish question, the disappearance of every single Jew in an efficient way. It took these brilliant people only 90 minutes to come up with a plan. The plan was simple: create death camps, gas chambers, crematoria. Take all the Jews of Europe, put them into cattle cars, bring them to these camps, and as they arrive, gas them and burn them. And so in my town in Slovakia, on a Friday night, there's a knock on the door. 1,800 out of 2,000 Jews are stuffed into the synagogue, locked up there. There's no room. Synagogue is a very small place. It can hardly seat 500 people. The synagogue has no bathrooms and no running water, but who cares? They're not people. They're the demon. They don't need privacy. Day and a half later, they march the train into trains and they're gone. 1,800 out of the 2,000 Jews are gone to Majdanek and Auschwitz, not to be heard from again. But I am still at home because my father is still running Albert's business. 3 months go by, my grandparents are arrested. We get them out and we know we're in trouble. And so we leave. Where do we go? We go to Hungary. Hungary was partner to Germany. They were anti-Semitic. They had anti-Semitic laws. But they decided it's much more practical and economically much better if you take the Jewish men, put them into a slave labor force, attach them to the army, let them do all the physical labor. Build the roads, fix the bridges, clean the tanks and the horses, while the families are at home supplying food to them. And this way, we get benefit out of it. And when the war is over, when we win the war, then we'll dispose of them. But meanwhile, the Jews of Hungary are alive. And so we get to Hungary. I live in a small village with my aunt, my grandparents, my brother. My father and mother are off to Budapest because my father needs a job. And waiting for the war to end. After all, it's 1943. It's the end of 1943, beginning of 1944. The German army is being defeated. The American army has taken over all of Italy. Russia is already in Poland. Bombing of every city in Germany is day and night. Any moment now, Germany will capitulate. I'll be alive. We must admit it's a pretty good plan. Unfortunately, that did not what happened. What happened is that in the spring of 1944, Germany and the Hungarian Nazis realized there are still 750,000 Jews alive in a small country. They have not achieved the final solution. And so that's how I got to Auschwitz. I was tattooed, stripped of everything, stood in formation, finally assigned to work with horses. I was a city kid. I knew nothing about horses. And suddenly I am there in charge and working with two huge Belgian workhorses. In some way, you can imagine this kid. He's 14 years old. These two huge monstrous horses, and I'm trying to get them in the field, put some bits into their mouths. Who knows how to do that? But I learned quickly, because if you didn't learn quickly, you didn't last very long. And so I learned how to plow the fields and how to harness a horse to a wagon and to a plow. Work was very hard. Very little food. Black coffee for breakfast. Soup for lunch. Piece of bread at night. Now imagine turning 15. I was always hungry. I was always tired. But I went on because I wanted to live, and my brother kept encouraging me. And so we continue and we hear the news. The Russian army is getting closer. And closer. But the work's still hard. And some nights when we come back from work, rather than going into our building and getting a piece of bread and going to sleep, we are told to go and take a shower. The problem in Auschwitz with showers was the fact that they're wonderful. The problem was, after you got undressed on many occasions, as you're walking into the shower, there'll be a doctor look at you naked and determine if you should continue to live. He would simply look at you, look at the number on your arm, and determine life and death. My brother and I survived. It's January of 1945, the Russian army, 50 miles from Auschwitz. A short distance. Maybe they'll make it quickly. But on the 18th of January, 60,000 inmates from Auschwitz are marched out on a death march. You march or you die. I'm hungry, I'm tired, I'm cold. It's winter time. By the way, winter in Poland is even worse than in Denver. I've been here in the winter time. I tell my brother, I'm tired, I'm hungry, I'm cold. He says, keep walking. Keep walking, because someday this war will be over and you have to stay alive. Besides, he tells me, say a prayer or two. Don't be so into your physical needs. Look at some of your spiritual needs. Say a psalm. And so he encourages me. Finally, after 3 days, we arrive in a new place, Buchenwald. Buchenwald was a concentration camp, not a death camp. There were no gas chambers, no food either. A boiled potato was more than you hoped for a whole day. There were actually days where we got soup. But then there were days we got no food at all. One day my brother is taken away. He's gone. I'm alone. I'm trying to survive. I keep losing weight, hoping that the American army will come. In the distance we hear planes bombing the cities around Buchenwald. We have large weapons going off. Planes overhead. Hoping. The beginning of April. Death march again. I keep hiding. I can't march. I'm now 75 pounds. I can hardly drag myself. So I decide that I'm going to hide. And I hide day after day. First day, by the 10th of April, I'm hiding under a building in a crawl space with a few other people. That day, a guard comes with a dog, finds us, marches out to the front of the gate. There I am, with 10,000 other Jews in front of the gate, standing in formation, with guards on both sides. I need help. I need a miracle. On that day, the American army was bombing the area the whole day, and therefore, we were not shipped out. I survived another day. The next morning, the guards disappeared. The American army arrives. They feed us. I'm alive. I'm going to reach my 16th birthday someday. Nobody wants to kill me anymore. And the war is over. And the American army says, we'll take you any place you want to go. So I say to myself, where shall I go? I decide I'm going to go back to the village from where I was taken. Because if anybody in my family is alive, they'll come back there. I was hoping. And so I get there after a few days of travel. First person I see, I ask him, did anybody from the Roth family come back? And nonchalantly says to me, yes. I say, where? I run over, I open up the door, and there is my mother. I say, hi, Mom. My mother fainted out of sheer joy. My parents survived. They survived because somebody was willing to help them. Before the Jews of Budapest were taken, or shot in the street and dumped into the Danube, my father gets sick. Typhus. He's in a coma. Everybody gives up. Except one night nurse, a Christian woman. She does not give up. She keeps sitting every night trying to talk him into waking up. And finally, after many, many nights, he mumbles, how long have I been asleep? As clear as can be. But the Jews are being shot on the street, and so what does my father and mother do? They have no place to go. This wonderful lady tells my parents, you can hide in my apartment. This Christian woman, living in a one-bedroom apartment with her daughter and granddaughter and a son-in-law who's not at home. He's in the army. Let my parents come to her apartment and hide. Police come and look for Jews. They don't find them. One night there's a knock on the door. Into the hiding place they go. It's not the police. It's the husband. The Hungarian Nazi soldier comes home for 3 days. The wife decides she must do something to kind of explain these two extra people. Because in a one-bedroom apartment, you can't quite hide without anybody knowing. And so she tells him about these distant relatives who are living with us, you know, the war and all that, and besides, they're hiding here. But you mustn't tell anybody. If you do, the police will come, drag him out, and shoot him. And if you want to go to bed with me tonight, you're going to keep your big mouth shut. So the war is over. Nazism disappeared. It's been defeated. Does that mean anti-Semitism disappeared? No. My old neighbors don't welcome me back with a red carpet and a band. They say, he's still alive? We thought we got rid of him already. And so there's no place for the Jews to go. Must leave. Where do you go? No place to go. Palestine is still being controlled by the British. Build warships into the Mediterranean and making sure no Jew sneaks in because they limit the number of Jews per year to 15,000. That 200,000 Jews in DP camps, in displaced persons camp, the same camps they were in, but now they're fed well. No place to go. And finally, after 2 years, the United Nations decides to let the Jews establish their state in Palestine, the ancient homeland, the place that God said this is what I'm going to give you. So the UN agreed with God, I guess. They don't always do that. And so the places where the Jews lived became the state of Israel. The places where the Arabs lived became a Arab state. And that would be perfectly reasonable to most of us, but that's not what happened at all. The day Israel declares its state, 5 Arab armies attack Israel. And since then, they've been attacking in every way possible. 5 wars. And the propaganda machine. Unfortunately, their propaganda has been successful. The Jew is again demonized. He's everything you can think of, everything bad. Above all, the Jewish state practices apartheid. Apartheid? Racism? No. Some of you may have been in Israel. Go to any hospital. What will you find? You'll find the Jews and Arabs and from all over the place, from the West Bank, from Egypt even. Particularly if they have a very serious sickness, since most of the Arab world does not have very sophisticated facilities. The closest place that you can get real serious health care is in Israel. 20% of the student population of the University of Jerusalem is Arab. That's apartheid. Get on a bus. Don't try to get a seat. You'll find Jews and Arabs and Christians, whoever else, sitting on the same bus. Last time I checked, that was not apartheid. But unfortunately, the media has bought into it. And they have infiltrated our university system. The Islamic fundamentalist movement has infiltrated into our university system. They bought professors. After all, if you tell a professor you're an assistant professor, you're just starting out, we can make you a full professor. Not only that, we can make you the head of the department. We create a department of Islamic studies or Middle Eastern studies, and we'll give you that chair. Well, that's not bad, is it? As a small detail, to establish a department, you need $50 million. Not a problem. Saudi Arabia has plenty of money. We give it to them. And so professors in universities in the United States buy into these lies. Muslim student associations directed and funded and trained in the issue of anti-Semitism and anti-Israel are on the campus. Demonization all over again. Isolation. Economic boycotts. In fact, very recently, about 2 weeks ago, the student body of the University of California, that's all those universities together, voted to boycott, divest, and sanction against Israel. They poured into it. Nations around Israel are trying to destroy it. Iran is trying to build a nuclear weapons. And a few weeks ago, he was here, the president, Ahmadinejad. His comments were very simple. I will wipe Israel off the face of the earth. That's his promise. The question is, because without America, Israel alone cannot do it. America is the most essential part of Israel's existence today. I Are we going to stand by and do exactly the same thing as we did in 1930? When Germany begins to expand, will we give a damn? Are we going to stand by while they build nuclear weapons? My friends, we must stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. Not just for Israel. For civilization, for Western civilization, because they don't want us to exist. But my friends, I don't despair. I don't despair. I don't despair because, as the pastor said, God promised the children of Israel to gather them back, and he did. But there's another reason I don't despair. Because there are Christians in this country, 1.25 million Christians, who belong to an organization conceived and put together by Pastor Hagee, who you will hear this evening, of an idea. Gather Christians all over the country. Let them support Israel. They know why theologically. We'll see how we do it. And so Kufai is born, and Kufai is in the churches, on the college campus. And I have the privilege, actually, traveling with some of these wonderful young people. We go from college to college, from university to university, to the California universities, explaining the lies that the Muslims are perpetrating. 100 chapters have been formed in the last 3 years. The challenge is to double that number. Through you, the number of chapters of Kufai on the university campus will double and triple. Christians who are growing up today on American college campus will hear the truth, and they'll be out there when they are 15 years from now, where they are members of Congress and Senate and even a president. They'll understand why America must stand with Israel. And so I don't despair. Israel has an army, an air force. Christians are here to support Israel. And I'm hoping more Christians join. In fact, to quote Pastor Hagee, when we passed the 1 million member mark, he says, we have 1 million members. Now all we have to do is convince the other 49 million evangelical Christians to join. And I hope they will. It's up to you. It's up to you. And that is why I don't despair, because you're here this morning listening to me, understanding what has happened to your Jewish people, and know what we all must do to save the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Irving. Thank you so much. Why don't you remain standing while Irving's going to make his way out there to the table, and we're going to dismiss with a word of prayer as he does. It's a sobering story, but it's real. And this has happened, thinking 6 million people were killed during that particular time. And basically, no one did very much. There were Christians that hid many Jews. There were some efforts made. But we're living in a day when there's another challenge. And that's a challenge for the very existence of the nation of Israel and the Jewish people having a right to be in that land. It's being fought, and we as Christians, we have a responsibility. God told us very specifically that I've set watchmen on the wall that will give him no rest until he establishes peace in the city of Jerusalem. We're the watchmen, folks. We're the watchmen because we're the ones that know how to pray. We're the ones that have the ear of our God through our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So we need to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. We need to actively be involved where we can be involved. That's what Christians United for Israel is all about. you're here today and you're going to see many things, and hopefully there are going to be sobering things, there will be eye-opening things, there's going to be celebration time, but all of it goes together because the bottom line is God is faithful. His will be performed in the end, period. It's going to be that way. So I encourage you.
We hope that this message has spoken something personal to you. If you would like more information about our church family or service times, please call us at 303-424-2121 or visit us at our website, www.fbci.org. Faith Bible Chapel currently meets in our Family Worship Center, located on the corner of 62nd Avenue and Ward Road.